Hi guys, I'm Dick Smith. I'm a retired judge here in Madison. I'm an accidental climate activist. I got involved in this through no fault of anybody here. I'll skip that. About 4 years ago, I discovered this problem, and it was one of those, my retirement plans just changed. I got a plan, and part of it I'm going to execute today with Mary's permission. Let me ask you this. In the spirit of a retreat, usually I do a stand-up lecture. I go for, you give me 40 minutes, I'll go 40 minutes. You give me an hour, I'll do an hour. And I can do that. But what I really thought was, look, there's a reason you are here. And retreats, I think, are in the spirit of reflection and thoughtfulness. And I thought I'd ask, instead of me just lecturing at you, which I can do, you tell me kind of what it is that brought you here. And I want to give a little setup so we have some context. I have two yardsticks today that I use for measuring success. they're what I use for every speech. It's, Dick, you gave me hope. This can be a depressing topic, and you know, there's a lot of bad science, all right?
Yeah.
And yet there are some solutions to this problem. And I believe that very strongly. And secondly, that I want to help. I'm really not here to entertain you or educate you. I'm here because I need your help. And I'm hoping the people in this room will say, you know what, I want to help this guy. So as we're talking today, I'd ask you to think to yourself, do I want to be helping people like him? Let me give it a little sense here. Here's what adults, according to Gallup, worry about the most. And it's a lot of things up there. You got the economy and federal spending and the size of government, healthcare, unemployment, you can go down that list. Hunger and hopelessness, not a bad list. Crime and violence, terrorist attacks, the availability of energy, and the affordability. Drug use, illegal immigration, quality of environment, and you see climate change is down pretty near right near the bottom.
Yeah.
It's on the list, okay? It's on the list of a lot of things that people care about, but they don't worry about it the most. Okay, that's for sure. I generally think, and for the context of this, it makes some sense, there are two reasons people care about climate change. One is self-interest, themselves, their family, their friends, their neighbors, their community, that local here and now kind of thing, and the social justice aspects of it. You all have moral and ethical or religious values that brought you here and bring a lot of people to climate change. I say a lot of our group, it's one of the more interesting groups I've ever worked with. I'm with Citizens Climate Lobby. We've got a network of 15,000 people around the country. We are trying to do one thing, pass a revenue-neutral carbon tax through the federal government. We lobby them relentlessly, persistently, and politely. But we are all focused on the same thing. And it's funny, the one thing about the group that struck me immediately is about half the people in it are saints and half of them are sinners. We've got a very strong religious component. People drawn to climate change because of their religious beliefs. Now we got a bunch of atheists who could care less about religion, but have some very strong social values or scientific values, whatever it is that brought them. And we never even talk about religion or morality or those kinds of things. But the social justice aspect of it, I think, is that the people hurt the first and the worst are those that did the least to cause it, okay? And the second part is intergenerational. We've got about 10 years to turn this thing around at the most. Decisions we make are going to affect the next 40 generations, and I'll show you some of that. So here's my question. I have two of them that I'd ask you to think about. If I sent you, here are some of the kinds of things we do, from simple to a little more, takes a little more organization. Once a month, we ask everybody to write a two-paragraph letter to a member of Congress, handwritten letter. It can be three, it can be four, but two is fine. Talking about climate change and hopefully the need for a carbon tax or something like that. But just a letter to a member of Congress. I pick on Ryan because he's now chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. He is the key to letting a Republican introduce a proposal like this. We are not going to introduce this proposal without a Republican on it. Because once it goes in, if it's just a Democrat, we've had a lot of carbon tax bills. Democrats have introduced them all. That, once it goes in, it's branded by whatever party puts it in. And we are not going to pass a bipartisan bill without Republican support. So most of our effort is based on conservatives. There's the practical fact this time that they have both houses of Congress. So that's important, too. So Paul Ryan's pretty important. Other kinds of things. Write a 200-word letter to the editor once a month. Get Reverend Ingham. Is that how you say your name?
Ingham, yeah.
Ingham, to be one of our 100 faith leaders in June. We have a lobby day in June, actually a lobby week in June. We're going to meet. Last year we met with 507 different members of Congress over the course of the week. There's only 535. We're trying to bring 100 faith leaders to Washington with us who care about this issue. We'll talk more about that later. Attend a meeting once a month. We have a once-a-month meeting, kind of like you have out here. Usually about 30, 35 people show up. And we are part of a national call, actually international call. There are about 15 countries where we have chapters, but there are 269 CCL chapters around the world, most of them here in this country, trying to get this revenue-neutral carbon tax passed. So we all sit down once a month, and there's a, you know, our executive director nationally, and we bring in program speakers. They talk for about 20, 30 minutes. Bill McKibben. We have a mix of people from environmental types and climate types to political types, economists, technologists, it's military people. They are world leaders. We've had some really important people. But anyhow, we listen to about 20 minutes of that. We do about 20 minutes of business, and we do about 20 minutes of here's what's going on in other chapters, stimulate you, give you ideas, and then we go home. Oops, I'm sorry. Lobby teams. We do a lot of lobbying. We lobby in Washington once, twice a year, actually. We have two formal efforts. And then locally, 95% of our work is trying to get the opinion leaders back home, the people that members of Congress are going to listen to understand this proposal and to act on it, to help us get it. So we have local lobby teams that work on that, and it's just a matter of outreach. So those are the kinds of things we do, just in general. And since retreats are for reflection, as I said earlier, to me, climate change breaks into six basic issues. The first two are pretty bad. The science of global, it's depressing. It's a bad news story. The science of global warming and the impacts. You've all heard of some of the impacts of global warming. We're starting to get extreme weather, food shortages, water shortages, drought, too much water, too little water, acidified oceans, lots of things from A to Z. There are also the, you know, sea level rise, SLR there, is one of the social justice problems that people around the world who are going to be affected by this don't have the ability to adapt. Some of these problems we simply can't adapt to. The problem on the science side and the impact side, each new study is worse than the one that came out last week, last month, last year. On the technology and economics, the interesting part is it's just the opposite. This is the good news story. We've got the technology to solve it. It's easily affordable. And, you know, we know what to do. It's not a matter of lacking technology. We don't need a miracle. We don't need to delay and pray. You know, that is not a strategy. And the last one is what I call the mixed news, the politics and the media. Politicians, economists estimate costs, really politicians allocate them, okay? They allocate them among individuals, among businesses, states, nations, generations. That's what politicians do. They allocate costs and benefits. And the media, the referees in all this, we got an invisible problem. They are not doing their job. They need to blow the whistle, call the fouls, and be much more. They need to be a hell of a lot smarter than they are, to be blunt about it. They are not doing the job. So those are the areas I can talk about and focus on. I want to go back a little bit to, too much. What would keep you from helping me? Why aren't you already involved in this? And I'd like you to be as honest as you can, you know, and what barriers, what kinds of things are keeping you from getting involved in something like this? You know, friends, family, colleagues make fun of you. Are you bashful? You don't know enough about the problem or the solutions. You're worried about somebody asking you for money. By the way, we have no dues. We are a totally volunteer organization. And in politics, it's you make a lot of people think money matters most. So what's the use? I got no money. You know, we can't beat them. Anyhow, those are the two questions. What do you want to know? You know, what is it you really want to know today? And what's keeping you from, what do you think might keep you from getting involved? And then I can talk and answer any questions you've got.
Well, I think I'll step in here and say, you know, I've heard about the carbon tax and some descriptions of it, but I don't really understand exactly how it would work.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm here, too.
Yeah.
Because I know all, you know, I feel like I've got a really good base on the basic problem, but I don't really understand the carbon tax.
Okay.
And I'd like to, you know, to defend it, I'd like to know more about it.
And I know Mary's name. Your name is?
Barbara.
Okay.
I'm interested in the politics because I'm German, and I know that these things, and that means I'm European, and Europe has been much more progressive on this years ago.
Absolutely.
And particularly Germany.
Okay.
And so do we ever look to another country, or are we always focusing only on the greatest country of the world? This is what drives me nuts.
And what's your name?
My name is Rosemarie.
Rosemarie. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rosemarie. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm interested in the, I'd like to talk a little bit about the science and specifically about technology, what types of things the carbon tax would fund, and
sure.
I'm skeptical that there's much we can do to, I think there's things we can do to slow this, but I'm not sure there's anything we're going to do to stop it.
Okay. Anybody else? And your name is?
I'm John.
Hi, John. I'm Dick again.
I'm Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
I think we've all heard about Bill McKibben, and most of us have heard about his organization, 350.org. My question is, what are they advocating?
Sure. And I'm on the steering committee of 350.org, so I know a little about that group, too.
But I've never heard of CCL.
Okay.
And I'm interested in knowing how many people in Wisconsin are involved with that.
Sure. We have one of the larger groups in the country. We have about 13 different chapters in the state of Wisconsin alone. We've got every congressional district covered pretty well, although we need to do better in Ryan's district. But I'll go to that. Okay, 350 versus CCL. But you know the short answer? Let me answer his question first, because this one goes to the heart of it for me. I looked around and I said, you know, 350 is a great thing. We need to do this. I've been involved with, you know, tar sands and all of that. I led the divestment fight here on campus, pulled together the faculty that fought it, drafted the resolution, et cetera. So I've been very active in 350. But mostly 350 is if you like street theater and you want to go march, go march. We need you. If you're serious about wanting to get involved in the solution and work with the people that are going to put the solution together and can put on a coat and tie, I'll talk about that. That's the CCL side of it. Okay, it's a very adult group. That's it, and we're adults who act like adults. And when I need to just yell and shout, I get involved at 350 and we'll talk about that. Yes?
Yeah, so I'm interested in CCL's specific proposal and some of the logistics there. One of the things I think is really interesting about the topic is we talk about the science, and that's almost exclusive to the environmental science, but we don't, or at least the conversation doesn't tend to take an approach like what is the economic science, what is economic.
That's the ball game right now.
Yeah,
is the political discussion.
And what is the economic theoretical basis for engaging kind of the other side of saying, no, this is a valid policy based off of almost capitalist economic principles and free market principles, saying that it's bearing the cost of making
You can give my speech. That is my speech. You've got Naomi Klein on one side saying we've got to do away with the capitalist system if we're going to solve this problem.
Yeah.
I'd say we don't have time.
Yeah.
Okay, that's going to take a wee bit of time, and I think it's a little unrealistic.
And it's that argument that's going to get people like Ryan.
Right.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And
yeah.
We
yeah.
are,
Boston
our proposal are.
Tons of
it's based on the University of Chicago economic principles.
Absolutely. Well, George Shultz, for what it's worth, George Shultz he's held more cabinet positions than any other American. He was Reagan's Secretary of State. He's also been Treasury and Labor, and he was the OMB director. But anyhow, he is on CCL's Board of Directors. Okay, and what's important for Republicans when we go talk to them is not that he was held all these cabinet positions. It's that Shultz was the chairman of the economics department at not just any university, but the University of Chicago. And he is gung-ho on a revenue neutral carbon tax. That's why he's on our board. And you get a chance too. You got anything you want to hear about?
I'm really interested in like the idea of the nuts and bolts. How would the carbon tax work to improve the situation?
This was worthwhile. I would have spent more time on the science. I'm going to go light on the science. I apologize. But I will cover some of it because some of it you got to get a little. I'm going to go heavier on our proposal. So I'm going to skip a lot of slides. But it's a two-step process. CCL is, Citizens Climate Lobby is. You got to get educated, and that's the fun part for most people. Then you got to get political, and that's the heavy lifting for most people. They've never done it. It's new to them, and what does it mean? All right, here's our philosophy. This is the organizational stuff. Our philosophy is the world does not need one more angry group, okay? We have one rule, but it is a doozy. You need to respect and appreciate every member of Congress and his or her staff for their public service. If you can't do that, you can't work with us. I compare it to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We're kind of a diverse group. We got bashfuls and we're littered with docs, okay? We got a lot of docs, you know. And we've got happies. We are a remarkably happy group. We have a good time together, but no grumpies, okay? We can't, yeah, that's why I tell, we can't use grumpies because they can't build long-term relationships, and that's what we're trying to do and are succeeding. Our goal is a revenue neutral carbon tax. We don't have any dues. We need your time and talent. And the one thing that separates CCL from any other group I've ever been involved in is the incredible support we get at the national level. The reason we have no dues, we had a multimillionaire start this thing. I won't go through his story, but he basically got it off the ground, funded a couple of staff people, and we're still a razor-thin organization. We have 14 staff nationally. That's absurd for what we're doing. And seven of them are the policy. I am in some good company. We go to Washington a couple of times a year. We've got about 15,000 people nationally. About 1,000 of them will go to Washington this summer. We're going in June again. We'll do a week of lobbying. That's when we want the faith leaders to join us. And it isn't just amateurs. James Hansen, how many of you know James Hansen is this country's most esteemed climate scientist. His three claims to fame. He taught Al Gore climate science. Al Gore says, this is the guy who taught me. And he testified in front of Gore's committee 25 years ago, and he's the guy who he's credited with starting the climate science movement, all right? Most impressive is the work of Citizens Climate Lobby if you want to join the fight to save the planet, to save creation for your grandchildren. There's no more effective step you can take than becoming an active member of this group. That's Hansen. He's a terrific guy. I already told you about Shultz. He's on our board. We're not all amateurs. We get a comment about Republicans. The economic advisors to every president since Jimmy Carter support a carbon tax. Okay? That is the preferred solution here. There's a reason economists line up behind this. A couple of them, and I'll go into that if I have time. But Arthur Laffer, let me point to Reagan's guy. All right? Some of you are old enough to know Arthur Laffer. The Laffer curve on the back of a napkin, trickle-down economics, that's him. Mr. Conservative. He is lobbying for a revenue-neutral carbon tax with us. I mean, this is the kind of support. This is a good idea. All right. Greg Mankiw, George Bush's chief economic advisor, says the closest thing to a free lunch is a carbon tax in economics. That's the closest thing economics has to a free lunch. So this is not a partisan issue from the economist side. The four former Republican EPA administrators, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, all supported Obama's power plant rules. This goes back to Nixon, okay? All four of them. But in their op-ed to the New York Times, they all wrote a joint op-ed. They started with a market-based approach like a carbon tax would be the best path for reducing carbon emissions. We have Catherine Hayhoe on our board. Catherine Hayhoe, last year, Time Magazine said she's one of the most 100 influential people in the world. She is a national treasure. You can just Google her, listen to any video. You will see one of the calmest. She is the alter ego of Dick Smith. I am hyper, I really get involved. I'm passionate. She's calm, deliberate, and a scientist. She's an evangelical, married to an evangelical minister. And together they've written a book about why evangelicals should be involved in the climate movement. She is really special. Bill McKibben is not on our board, founder of 350, but he says, I love working with Citizens Climate Lobby. Their relentless focus on the need for a fee and dividend solution is helping drive the debate in precisely the right direction. I'm enormously grateful. So these are, you asked who is CCL, this is who we are, a mix of amateurs, and really, I think we've got a solid board. I'll skip why I got into this. Ron Johnson got me into this. He said, well, it's the sun. And I read a little blurb, and he was running against Feingold. I will tell you, a couple of weeks before the election in 2010, I'm out having coffee like this with I was a judge. We're having coffee at the Glass Bank downtown. Friday morning, we did it every week. Five or six of us are sitting there. I read the little blurb. Ron Johnson says, I don't believe in global warming. I don't think it's happening. But if it is, it's the sun, not people. Everybody started laughing. The nicest thing anybody said was, what an idiot. And I leaned on the one laughing the hardest and saying the most was to my right. And I went, okay, smart guy. What if Ron Johnson came in right now, sat down, what would you tell him? Why is he wrong? That's your homework assignment. Why is he wrong? Okay, I didn't have a clue. Everybody shut up. Or they tried, and then they shut up. Nobody had a clue what they would say to the senator. You know, he comes in. What are you going to tell him? I didn't know. They didn't know. We didn't really know. We knew he was probably wrong, almost certainly wrong, but we didn't know why. I went back to the office, and I went like this. Cleared my desk, hold my calls. I want an answer. I spent all day on it. I went home all weekend. I got off the computer Sunday night and said, how could I have not known this? Because this is 5 years ago. I should have known better. I knew nothing. And I got real smart over the weekend, and that's when I knew my retirement plans were going to change. All right. So that's why it's not the sun. There's a lot of reasons it's not the sun. There's two kinds of people, the kiss people and the puzzle people in my life. The kiss people, keep it simple, stupid, give me the big picture. That's all I can do today. If you're a puzzle person and you love details and complexity and you're a show me, boy, is climate change your issue. You can do it on the science, the impacts, the economics, the technology, the politics, media. All those areas are incredibly fascinating. But I don't have time. You want to get into the greenhouse gas story? There it is. And there it is again. The KISS version. CO2 is a major problem. Okay, first of all, it's human greenhouse gases. And the major gas is CO2. Where does it come from? Coal, oil, and natural gas. That's 80% of the emissions. Okay, that's the big problem. The takeaway point is this. There are other greenhouse gases. They're gone in a couple of years. A couple of months, some of them. Okay? CO2 stays up there forever. Take a look at that sentence down at the bottom. The climate impacts of CO2 will last longer than the radiation from our nuclear waste. The gallon of gas that I used to get out here today, anybody 168 pounds in this room or close to it?
Well, that's me, yeah.
168 pound, I didn't mean to embarrass you.
No, I'm not embarrassed at all.
Willem needs about 2,500 kilocalories a day. That's what you get out of a gallon of gas, okay? 2,500 kilocalories a day. That's useful energy. The problem is it emits enough CO2 to trap 40 million times the useful energy. 100 billion kilocalories are going to be trapped over the lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere from that 1 gallon of gas. So that's what's happening here. Too much stays up there for too long. That's why CO2 is such a pernicious problem. It doesn't go away, or too much of it doesn't go away. The threshold for dangerous warming is 2 degrees Celsius. okay? If we warm this planet 2 degrees from pre-industrial levels, that is really dangerous. There is a fight about that. Most people think it's lower, but the 194 nations agreed in 2009 that we got to stay below 2 degrees. That's about 3.6 Celsius, Fahrenheit, I'm sorry. So 2 degrees Celsius doesn't sound like a whole lot, but if we went 5 degrees in the other direction, Wisconsin would be under 2 to 3 miles of ice. We'd be in the deepest depths of an ice age. So 2C is huge. It comes mostly from CO2 emissions. We need to cut them 80% by 2050. That's the standard. Developed countries have got to do that. To do that, and this is just an accident of math, they're not related, 80% of the fossil fuel reserves that we already know about, not the new ones we're going after, have to stay in the ground. Somebody owns them. 75% are state-owned or privately owned. The Koch brothers, Russia, Saudi Arabia. They're worth about $30 trillion. If 80% of that stays in the ground, that's $22 trillion of stranded assets. Okay? $22 trillion. To put that in perspective, the savings on, not the savings and loan, the subprime mortgage debacle, when they collapsed, you know, those worthless subprime mortgages, do you know the value of them? Total value that was worthless? $2 trillion. $2 trillion. $28 trillion, we're talking roughly $20 trillion. It's a problem, okay? That's some of the big economics. Here are the basics.
That's the other side of it.
And then I'm going to get to the solution. I'm going to cover the basics and one more thing and then go right to the solution because I don't have time to do a lot of stuff. The five things you got to get your head wrapped around. The first three are the basic science. It is real. Global warming's happening. It's us. I do this in 10 words. It's dangerous. Scientists agree on those first three things. There is no scientific debate. That is the gateway belief to political action. That is what stops most people. They think there's a legitimate debate. There is none. And the fifth thing is important. People sit on the sidelines because they don't think there's anything we can do about it. I will tell you without proving it today, because I don't have time, we've got solutions that are technically feasible, economically affordable, and politically viable. I'm going to focus on the last one, because that's where most of the interest is. On this agreement thing, let me just show you what's happening to that CO2 in the atmosphere. This is the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, okay, on this side, in parts per million. This is 800,000 years out, an ice core sample, the furthest they can go back with the ice in Antarctica. And you see a series of ice ages, 8 of them, where the CO2 went up and down. CO2 is what drove and didn't drive it, between 200 and 300 parts per million. When it got down around 200 or a little under 200, you had an ice age. When it gets up, there's all of human civilization right there, okay, the last 10, 12,000 years. We've been up here. This is where we were in 2008 when this chart was put together, a little below 400 parts per million. In 1915, we crossed 300 parts per million for the first time, not just in 800,000 years, but in at least 3 million years through other things, and probably 15 million years. So this thing goes back, you know, around the room, that line does, under 300. We're at 400. In 2007, when this was put together, the lowest scenario for the end of the century was 550 parts per million if we kept doing what we're doing. The high scenario was 900. There's a reason for that. That was the worst case scenario that scientists imagined in 2007. They put out four scenarios. Well, they did it again. Every six, seven years, the IPCC puts out another report. In 2013, their worst case scenario was 1,910 parts per million. Just call it by the end of the century. So 1915, in 100 years, we went up 100 parts per million. In another 100 years, we're talking about potentially 1900, somewhere between 1,000. This is now the low end. This is now the high end. That's the problem. And there's some meaning to this. Skip all this. So the temperature goes up and it's been hot. And there's another temperature trend. And there's some more stuff. And it's all bad news. All right, and there's a consensus on all this. We've warmed about 1 degree since 1880 Celsius. It's us since 1950. If you add up all the natural factors that anyone's looked at, it would be slightly negative. We would have cooled a little bit. To a 95% degree of certainty, 100% of the warming since 1950 is us. I mean, the scientists agree, and it's dangerous. The consensus is overwhelming, and you can look at Wikipedia. That's really a great source for Google scientific consensus on global warming, and read your heart out in Wikipedia. They've got hundreds of links to the scientific organizations that say it's real, it's us, it's dangerous. And guess what? None of them disagree. You can look at the National Academies of Science, 38-0. The scientific organizations like chemists and physicists and agronomists and you name it, 100-0 around the world. Peer-reviewed articles. For every one denier, there's 500 articles that say it's real, it's us, it's dangerous. This was from 2010. And the authors of those articles, for every one denier, it was 1,000 authors. Who, you know, I mean, the consensus here is overwhelming. So we've got solutions. I'm going to skip the technology. I'm going to skip the economics. Take my word for it. It's feasible and it's affordable. I don't have time if I'm going to cover the other one. We'll go back later. Here's three real problems. That all of that would not have been enough to get me into this. I would not be here today if it weren't for these three timing problems. This is a unique social problem. It's down at the bottom of that list I showed you at the beginning on most people's worry list. Okay, there's a lot of other, well, it's at the top of mine and it's at the top for these three because there's no other social problem like this. Here's the 10-year problem. If we don't peak our CO2 emissions by 2022 at the latest, there and then drop significantly year after year, there is no way we're going to stay below that 2C threshold. We're going to blow past that 2C dangerous warming threshold. So the takeaway is this: unlike most social problems, climate change has a time limit. Second problem, the 1,000-year problem. 2009, a study led by climate scientist Susan Solomon, she's now at MIT, found that once we stop all CO2 emissions, we don't put one more ounce of CO2 in the atmosphere, temperatures won't drop significantly for at least 1,000 years. That's 40 generations. The next 40 generations. This is a problem that has no reverse gear. This is not like gay rights in the Supreme Court, where we can wake up tomorrow and say, let's let gay people marry, or prison reform, and we say, let's not put drug addicts in prison, or education, where we say, you know, our kids are not competing, we need to put more. This has no reverse gear, at least on any human time scale. All right, here's the one that really scares me. Those are the easy ones. This is the game over scenario. This is the one that terrifies me. You're in a car. You're driving toward a cliff. Here's the analogy, okay? We know the cliff is out there. There's a point at which we go over the cliff. And let me explain what the cliff is. The cliff for me is where human action doesn't matter anymore. Okay, that's game over. We can go to zero emissions and it isn't going to change anything because the planet is going to keep warming. The physics and chemistry of the Earth takes over. We have vast stores of carbon, four basic places, okay? Deep oceans, permafrost, the tropical forests, and the peat bogs. And they will release carbon. It's happened before. If you warm them enough, the permafrost melts. If you warm the deep ocean clathrates, the clathrate gun goes off, and huge amounts of carbon go into the atmosphere. Twice to three times to 10 times what's already up there. So, and it happened 55 million years ago. And the planet warmed by 20 degrees Celsius. That's the problem. And it was all physics and chemistry. Orbital changes released enough CO2, warmed the planet enough that these things fired up and there was this feedback loop and it kept warming. All right. So that's the game over. Human action doesn't matter. We don't know where that cliff is, okay? But we need to hit the brakes on emissions now, hard. We got our kids in this car. Instead of emitting more and more greenhouse gases each year, we've got to stop and go in the other direction, okay? Turn around and go backwards. Because once we go over the cliff, it's like hitting, what happens when you hit the brakes? Nothing. Okay, human action, you can hit those brakes all you want, gravity takes over. That's the problem. So that's why I'm in it. When do we go over that cliff? There is a legitimate debate about that. We've already warmed almost 1°C. The West Antarctic ice sheet, that's waste. A year ago in April, we learned we can't stop that anymore. We've crossed one tipping point. That ice sheet is going to melt, and the sea level is going to rise 4 to 10 feet. It's probably, actually, the new numbers are closer, 10 to 14 feet, because it is a little bigger than they thought. But that's going to happen. It's only a question of how fast, but that's one tipping point. At 2°C, the game over scenario I described is possible, but it's not likely. At 4 to 7°C warming, if we warm this planet 4 to 7°C from pre-industrial levels, that game over scenario is almost a certainty. Here's the problem. By 2100, here are the reports, some major reports, just between 2012 and 2014, that said if we do just what we're doing now, by 2100, we're going to warm 4 to 7°C. That scares the living bejesus out of me. These are conservative organizations, the World Bank, PricewaterhouseCoopers, the International Energy Agency, one of the most conservative bodies in the world, the IPCC, and the largest and one of the most respected general science bodies in the world, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, all saying this. We're 4 to 7°C by 2100. You think decisions we make now don't matter? They matter. So what do we do? That's what you wanted to hear about. Well, before we leave, everybody writes a letter. No, we'll skip that. Here's the thing. We need a federal price on carbon fuels that reflect their true social cost to society. There is no other industry that gets to dump its garbage for free. That's Bill McKibben's line out of Rolling Stone last year. You know, if I owned a restaurant and I could throw it out the back, I didn't have to pay for that. I could lower my prices and I have a competitive advantage over any other restaurant. That's what the fossil fuel industry has. They get to use our commons. This is the tragedy of the commons. Too many sheep on the commons. We got too much fossil fuel going up in the atmosphere. Sir Nicholas Stern is the former chief economist of the World Bank. In 2006, he wrote a very famous climate report for was the prime minister of England at the time. Anyhow, he starts off, global warming. Here's the problem, the case for the carbon tax. Global warming is the biggest market failure in history. Somebody mentioned markets earlier. Bottom line there, when markets fail, and they do, sometimes spectacularly, governments intervene. What kind of market failure we got? We have externalities, we have costs that are being shifted to non-users, okay? Those fossil fuels have real costs. Just, I'll give you three examples for us. Just on oil, the military cost to the United States is $8 trillion from 1976 to 2010 to get Middle East oil out to the world. Our share of that oil is less than 2%, 10% in 2010. The health costs of, that's $8 trillion. The health costs of coal, Harvard Medical School study in 2010 did a very serious landmark study on what are the health costs from the toxins and the mining and the pulmonary disease caused by coal. It's $345 to $500 billion a year. That's up to $500 billion each year from burning coal. We pay for that. That's in our health costs. That's in our Medicare costs. These are hidden externalities being paid to by non-users. And just on climate changes alone, in terms of extreme weather events right now, for every dollar the insurance companies pay, U.S. taxpayers pay $3. These are the kinds of market failures we have. When markets fail, governments have four choices in how they intervene. R&D, great idea. Okay, let's do more R&D. Let's get better solar and better wind and whatever we need. More efficiency innovations. It's a good idea, but it's not sufficient. It's not going to happen fast enough if that's all the federal government does. Subsidies, we can't afford it, and I can tell you there is zero political support for any kind of subsidies. Mm-hmm. Okay, we need to get rid of them all, but that's a slog too. Regulation, Obama's taken that approach. He did not want to. He said, I want Congress to act. I want Congress to send me a bipartisan bill. I want to sign a bipartisan bill. They wouldn't act. He went with EPA regs and is doing everything he can. Good for him. Fuel efficiency standards on cars and trucks, power plant standards, huge one. New power plants, old power plants, and he promised by 2016 when he leaves office, he'll have a methane rule. Well, we'll see. The fourth option, taxes. Arthur Pigou, 20th century, early 20th century, about 1915, wrote a famous book on economics, and he said, if you want less of something, in this case carbon, you tax it. Okay, how can we tax it? CBO says a carbon tax is a drag on the economy. You got to get some numbers in mind. Now you have to concentrate. You had enough coffee. Give you one example, and keep this rule of thumb in your head, because this is the debate at the national level. For every $10 a ton tax that you put on CO2, here's the effect on consumers. The federal government will get $55 billion in revenue. Oh, but let me make it clear. This is a one-time tax. First point of sale, when it comes out of the ground or across the border into the country. Now, assume all our taxes are passed on to consumers. The tax will raise $55 billion a year at $10 a ton, and your price at the pump will go up 10 cents a gallon. For each $10. Your price at the meter is going to go up about a penny per kilowatt hour. Okay, so that's what the Congressional Budget Office says. They also tell you, if you look at a $10 a ton carbon tax, it's going to slow job growth. It's got a negative effect on jobs. It's going to be a drag on the economy. It'll slow GDP growth. And at 10 bucks a ton, you're not going to cut emissions the way you need to cut them to get that 80% reduction by 2050. Oh my God, it's hopeless. No. CCL says, make three changes to that $10 a ton tax. First change, you got to increase it aggressively each year for at least the next 20 years by 10 bucks a ton. So the 10 years out, you're at $100 a ton. 20 years out, you're at $200 a ton until we get that 80% reduction we need. First thing that happens is nobody on Wall Street is going to lend a nickel to build a coal-fired power plant. You don't even have to sign the bill. You just need, you know, they know this is coming, by the way. They know a price on carbon is coming. The only question is how high, how fast. All right, so it's got to be aggressive. It's got to be big enough to get the emissions cuts. Second thing you do, make this tax revenue neutral. This is a new concept for most people. And I'll say, how many of you all have heard of Mark Twain, right? Mark Twain says, you know, the difference between the right word and almost the right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. The difference between a carbon tax and a carbon tax that's revenue neutral is that big. You need to understand this is not a small point. A revenue neutral carbon tax gives back every nickel. Government does not keep one nickel of the revenue. There are lots of ways to give it back. Some are smart, some are dumb. Our proposal is you give every nickel back to American households in equal shares. Every adult gets the same share. How many of you get Social Security? I see some gray hair. Yes, don't you love those checks? Once a month, we all get a check, but they're for different amounts, right?
So this is the Alaska model.
This is, no, it's not Alaska. Yeah, it's Alaska. It's actually, it's British Columbia. Alaska is sort of like this. They give a check back on the oil revenue
to everybody.
And the first two kids get a half share. If you got a family, first two kids get a half a share. If you do it that way, now here's the trick. Unlike Social Security, you and I and Bill Gates each get a check for the same amount. We all get the same share of that $55 billion, which will double to $110 billion. And you know, it keeps going up each year as the tax goes up. If you do it that way, two-thirds of American households will break even or come out ahead. They're going to get more back in that check than they're going to pay in rising energy costs. The reason for that has to do with the linear line on energy. The more income you make, the more carbon you burn. It's that simple. You fly in planes, you own two cars, you own an extra house, you got a powerboat, you buy more things. Most Americans are going to come out ahead or break even. So they're held harmless. That's important because you can't keep raising the price of energy on poor people or on middle class people and expect to have any political support for it. And that's one of the huge problems with Obama's EPA regs. There is no mitigation for the poor. They are going to suffer the most. So I got a real problem with that. So revenue neutrality is also the key, not just for progressives who care about the poor. It is for Republicans. They will not support. If you have a tax increase almost all Republican members of Congress have signed Grover Norquist's no tax increase pledge, right? What's the word I left out? It's not a no tax increase pledge. It's a no net tax increase pledge. Grover Norquist has said he could support a revenue neutral carbon tax if it were truly revenue neutral. Same with the Koch brothers pledge that most state officials have signed, including Governor Walker. All right, it's got to be revenue neutral. You got to give the money back. We're saying give it back to consumers. I'll show you why. Don't give it back just to businesses. All right, third thing, you got to protect American businesses. Their prices are going to go up, right? China, let's assume China or India don't have a comparable system for reducing emissions. What are you going to do? They can't. They're going to have a competitive advantage over our companies. What you do is you put a border tariff on them based on the carbon content of their products. It's perfectly legal under WTO. It's not discriminatory in any way. It falls under two different sections. One, it's not a discriminatory tax. Secondly, it falls under the environmental exceptions provision of WTO.
It's okay with the TPP that they're just...
We don't know. TPP is a huge issue for everybody, everybody, on
What's
all
TPP?
Kinds of issues. Trans-Pacific Partnership,
NAFTA.
Free trade. We don't know what's in there. Nobody knows the extent to which that will be a problem for this. But I can tell you the last few Democrats finally get this. We've been lobbying on this for 4 or 5 years now. We have said you have to respect Republicans' position on this. You cannot take money and do good things with it. You can't. You've got to just, it has to be a revenue neutral tax. McDermott and out of Washington and Van Hollen out of Maryland each have separate bills this session. They had the same bills last session. There were variations on a carbon tax. Van Hollen, when he put it in, he said, I'm crediting CCL with this border adjustment thing and revenue neutrality. They're right. That we know we have won. Democrats are finally, at least the ones that are the leaders on climate change, understand these last two things and are finally beginning to respect them, that we can't pass a bill without that. But their ambition is still not good enough. They're not ambitious enough bills. All right. So if you make those three changes, right, to what CBO had, here's what you get. Regional econometric models is the best. They are the gold standard for tax analysis. 47 of the 50 states use REMI, R-E-M-I, regional econometric, for their tax analysis. They have REMI models. It's used by labor unions and the American Petroleum Institute. They are the best. We spent, one of our members gave $100,000 of his own money to, he knew this, and he said, we need a REMI study on this. What's gonna happen? And we have briefed members of Congress on this and their staffs. We had standing room only briefings in November. They were incredible. I can tell you about that if we have time. I want you to understand the proposal. Jobs go from negative to positive. Remember I said CBO says you do a car, if you do it the way with those three changes, in 10 years you'll have 2.1 million more jobs than you would have had in the economy. In 20 years, by 2035, you'd have 2.8 million. That's a full 1% more jobs than you would have had. And remember, this is just a tax change. This is not an environmental policy change. Second thing that'll happen, and they're a tax analysis firm, the effect on GDP becomes positive, goes from negative to positive. GDP will grow at least $70 billion a year, 5 years out. It'll start growing immediately. It'll hit $70 billion, starts to tail off. But the cumulative impact, we will be, as a nation, $1.3 trillion richer over the 20-year period. We don't lose money. We don't lose jobs. We gain it with this kind of a tax change.
Now, is that because you're putting more money into the pockets of the
poor? You get it. And the middle class. And everybody. 75% of our economy is consumer spending. You put it in the hands of consumers, you get this.
Give rich people money, they put it in the
bank.
Bingo.
All right. Stock market.
I got to keep talking. CO2. This is why I'm in this game. It gets us the cuts we need. We get 30 by two. In 10 years, we're 31% below 1990 levels, which is what we're talking about here. 50% below, and we're heading on our way toward that 80% cut we need by 2050.
We're talking emissions, not carbon.
We're talking emissions. We're talking CO2. I can't get into the other greenhouse gases. CO2 is the big kahuna.
I mean, we're not talking percentages in the atmosphere, because that's going to stay up no matter what.
That will stay up no matter what. We are talking emissions. Yes, it's not the concentrations. It is the emissions will stop. They will get that 80% cut by 2050, and we're going to have to keep cutting down toward 2100. But that's for some. That's the next generation.
Right.
Let's get our piece of this done. The study broke the U.S. into 9 census regions that basically CBO and everybody else uses. We do the best. That little Rust Belt area, Wisconsin's part of the 5-state region. Jobs go up nationally by 1%. They go up by 1.5% in our region. That's because we use so much coal, and there are no jobs in coal. You switch to alternative energies, and you put money into energy efficiency and conservation, and you're gonna come out ahead. There's the GDP, how it grows over the 20 years. You can see it gets up over 70 billion within 5 and stays above there. The CO2 emissions, that's the yellow line. There are other benefits, health benefits, 13,000 premature deaths avoided each year, 227,000 over 20 years. That's why medical experts love this. The healthcare doctors, we have a lot of support from doctors. Most American families, I've already been through this, the dividend exceeds the taxes. That's key. As the price goes up on the tax, you've got to keep, you can't do this on the backs of the poor and the middle class and expect to have political support. We come out ahead by far the best on the health benefits and the jobs. For most Americans, there's the curve on how the dividend goes up as the cost goes up. We call this a fee and dividend. Okay, that's the iteration of a carbon tax. That's not the right word I'm looking for. That's the that's the term for this kind of one. So, quick review. There's a fee on CO2 only at the first point of sale. There's a dividend check. That's the second element. All Americans get the same amount. And there's a border tax. That's it. Okay? 10 key principles. You want to know the economic? Here's what's embedded in this. Whoever it was that said capitalism, we're betting the farm on free market capitalism to solve this problem. Put a price on carbon. Let the market sort it out. We don't pick any winners. We are capital neutral. No cylinders, no hydrogen cars, no subsidies to sectors or to businesses. Okay, start with number one. We got to get the emissions cuts. The tax has to be big enough. That's one of our key problems. We need help with that, both with Republicans and Democrats. Revenue neutral, it's key. It should be key for Democrats. It is key for every Republican. Cannot use that money for anything else except giving it back. You could cut business taxes. I suspect that's what Republicans will do with it. There are other models for what you can do with it. If you want all the economic benefits I talked about, you want it in the hands as much as possible of consumers. But the principle is you can't do it. It is progressive. Most people will say a carbon tax is regressive, and they are. Not this one. Not this variation. It's comprehensive. This is another reason economists love it. It's not like cap and trade where there are offsets and loopholes and it's leaky as a bucket. You can get out 1,600-page bill. This is a 20-page bill. This is simple, transparent. It's easy to administer. One-time tax, just like a sales tax. Great records on what comes out of the ground. We know every country in the world has terrific records on fossil fuels. We know the carbon content of the product coming out of the ground. It's easy to tax. This is simple. All right, so it's comprehensive, every part of the economy. The other thing is, we have these long manufacturing chains in our economy. This tax, what it does is say, at different steps in the chain, it's going to make more sense to do efficiency innovations. Cut the demand for energy, right? Conservation, incredible efficiency innovations. Other places, it's going to make more sense to go with alternatives. Increase the supply of low carbon alternatives, wind, water, solar, nuclear. Sorry, I'll talk about that later. Okay, but it lets the market decide what's the best at each step. Protects American businesses from foreign competition with the tariffs. It's capital neutral. It starts small, so there's no shock. This is really going to be important for farmers. We have got to have a tax. I said it's an aggressive tax increase. From the farmer's perspective, they've got 20 years, a generation, to figure out a plan and how they're going to adapt. and they're probably going to get some mitigation outside of this bill. They're probably, in the ag bill, they're probably going to get some help. We need gradual, predictable price increases. One of the problems with cap and trade is it regulates a quantity, not a price. Utilities have no clue what the cost is going to be. They hate it. They can live with this. Do they love it? No. Can they live with it? Yes. It's easy to administer, and it's easy to get international cooperation. Okay, this is not, that's not a hard sell. Two reasons people tell you it's hopeless. Tell me it's hopeless. Republicans and money. I just show you, most Republicans support action on climate change. Poll after poll now shows that. A majority of Republican voters, a group of voters, 720-some that were under the age of 35, were given a list of one word to describe climate deniers. 53% of these Republican voters under 35 picked ignorant, out of touch, or crazy to describe deniers. There's no future for a party that, and they know this. I mean, we share this with Republican members. They are well aware of this. And most Republicans are not deniers. Lindsey Graham, by the way, says, go to any college campus. Lindsey Graham is good on this issue. He says every day we don't put a tax on carbon is a day that China moves ahead in the green economy. That was Lindsey Graham in 2010. The Lindsey Graham who faced a Tea Party primary this summer was a different Lindsey Graham for the last couple of years. He's not been very good. He's back on the team. Most Republicans aren't deniers. Okay, here's the truth. I have met now with scores of Republicans in over the last 3 years in Congress, with their staff, with them. Behind the scenes, most of them are not. Their problem is this. They say, look, the fringe of the party, we know the fringe of the party has captured the center on this issue. We want to get it back, but we want to get it back without a primary opponent funded with fossil fuel money. Got any hints on that? So that's the problem. So we're not fighting about the science. We are arguing about the economics. We need them to understand our proposal. That's why these briefings to Congress in November were so key. And they liked what they heard. We got rave reviews, bipartisan briefing for Republicans and Democrats. We did it in the House one day, in the Senate another day. And because Wisconsin is so well organized as an experiment, we got Remy, the guy who did Scott Nystrom, the Remy study and did the briefings, did a third day just for the Wisconsin delegation. And it was set up by two Republicans, Duffy and Ribble. Because we have developed long-term relationships with them and their staff. We have people working in their districts, just like we have people working with Scott or Mark Pocan. And they said, yeah, we'll do that for you. We'll invite everybody else from the delegation. We don't want to be called the host, but you know, we'll invite. And there were some word issues. Everybody showed up except Paul Ryan's staff, and he gave us a face-to-face meeting with the executive director of our group. That's the best we've got. It's a guy out of San Diego who met with him the next day. So we had a special briefing. All right, we desperately need Republican congressional leadership. That is the key to getting this done. They have led before on climate. They will lead again. What CCL is trying to do is to get them to do it sooner rather than later, because we are really running out of time. I've already shown you the advisors and the EPA, and there's a risky business study led by Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary in 2008 for Bush when the market collapsed. He got a couple of billionaire buddies together, Mike Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, and they funded something called the Risky Business Study. Most studies of regulation say, what's the cost of business of government regulation? These risky business guys says, what's the cost of business if government does nothing on climate change? Spent 9 months studying it. They had a lot of money. They got a great answer, which is it's incredibly more expensive. The cost of doing nothing on climate so greatly exceeds the cost of acting. Why do they support it? Because it's the closest thing to a free lunch, and like Lindsey Graham says, economics, we're losing the faith-based groups all over the world support it. I happen to see Unitarian Universalists, the UUs are on there. Defense Development and Diplomacy Committees get it. Let me talk money quickly. Three of the four richest companies in the U.S. are fossil fuel companies. There's the list. There's eight of the nine globally. It's depressing, right? It is very clear, if money matters most, we lose. I have worked for two governors, two speakers of the Wisconsin Assembly. Before I was a judge, I had 15 years in hardcore politics. I can tell you, in politics, the antidote to money is people. It does not, people do make a difference. Politicians will not create political will, but they will respond to it. So our job, this is my pitch to you as citizens, is to create the political will to act on climate. And this is my closing pitch. If people in this room, if you all, you know, leave the heavy lifting to people like me, my pitch is if people like you leave it to me, we aren't going to get this job done. I need your help. You've got to help. This is not one you can morally sit out. So, and this is when I speak to business groups. I tell them, give me your business card. If you want to help me. And I tell them before the speech, usually, I say, I want you to, how many of you got a business card? They all pull it out. Okay, put it on the table. Put it in front of you. And as I'm talking, I want you to be thinking, do I want to help this guy? And at the end of the speech, I'm going to judge how successful I am by how many of you give me your business card and say you're going to help. Any questions?
No, we gotta
over
go
my
over
time.
What kind of printouts do you have for us? Is the basic stuff on here?
Some of it. I grabbed what I had this morning. I am not the best guy in terms of organization. Yeah. Yes.
Do you have a website?
I'll get
we do. And it's, yeah. This is the national. And if you, here's the unique thing. We have a call every Wednesday night. One of our 7 staff members nationally answers questions from people all over the country, like you, who are new to this. They listen to a 1-hour call about our process, okay? It's a free call-in. You can get online, and you'll hear some of this, but not much. And really what it is a chance to answer. You've gotten a data dump. I dumped a lot of information on you. They'll answer questions about how we work, what we do. There's no dues. There's no obligation. We don't call them members. We call them supporters.
Where were you a judge?
Workers' comp. I was a director of leave. I ran the system. I was a director. And 10 years I did the judge work. State job. I was a state judge. I supervised about 20 judges around the state. Uh-huh. And it was... I was much happier as a judge than as the senior judge, let me tell you. And I went back to it at the end.
So now you're trying to travel around to all these places by bike, right?
I'll go anywhere, anytime. That's what I tell people. I will go where anybody will listen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dick, for being here.